Hello and welcome to the Many Rules of Film Club. This is Jeff Yance. I'm the program director at the Loft Cinema. And please welcome also Heather Lattes, occasional filmmaker.
Hi, Jeff.
Hello. And Rusty Boulay Stevenson, multimedia artist.
I choose the blue pill.
Ah, yes. Well, great that you mentioned that, Rusty, because today we're going to party like it's 1999.
Woohoo!
Yay.
As we talk about, I think we can all agree, one of the greatest years for cinema in recent memory, the year 1999. So there were a plethora of great films that year. But let's talk a little bit about what was going on in 1999 and why we think it was such a banner year for cinema.
Sure. Well, I mean, for one thing, I mean, just having lived through it, I've never known a year that people looked forward to as much as they looked forward to the year 2000, right? I mean, besides Conan O'Brien having a song.
No, that's exactly what
right, right? That's where you go right away. Right? But yeah. But there was that sense that it was a big deal. It was a bigger deal than 1998, than New Year's 1998 or 1997 or any other year that I've known.
Yeah, and Prince got the ball rolling the decade before. He was looking forward to it for many years.
Additionally, there was a thing called Y2K that everybody was very concerned about, this Y2K kind of glitch that could happen and make all the computers go haywire and everything would shut down. And so everybody was kind of holding their breath to see if that was really going to happen or not.
Yes, there was a lot of anxiety. There was millennial anxiety big time,
yes,
I think, in 1999. I think also cinematically, this was one of the last years of the great American independent film boom of the 90s.
Yeah, true independent cinema.
True independent cinema, the era of Miramax and New Line Cinema and all the great kind of indie distributors. Kind of starting with Pulp Fiction in the mid-90s, and this may have been
kind of the culmination.
The culmination, the last gasp, the culmination, or who knew? At the time, we thought maybe it was a harbinger of things to come, but I think it was maybe a last gasp.
Yeah, I think I definitely thought, I went and saw a lot of movies at the theater in 1999, and I thought we were seeing the future of filmmaking.
Yes.
We were seeing a lot of really great women in filmmaking. I thought that that was going to be the future. I thought we were going to see more leading female roles. I thought that was the future. I did not see that Mystery Men would actually be the thing that would be what was a harbinger of things to come, that it was all going to be superheroes. I didn't know that when I was watching Mystery Men.
Yeah, and a lot of great auteurs released films that year.
Yeah, I think we could even just list. I mean, I put this list together of directors who released films in 1999. It's really amazing.
Yeah, let's go. Say that.
So George Lucas, Martin Scorsese, Stanley Kubrick, Woody Allen, Jim Jarmusch, Spike Lee, Milos Forman, David Lynch, the Dardenne brothers, Pedro Almodovar, Paul Thomas Anderson, Wes Anderson, Robert Altman, Miyazaki, Mike Lee, Zhang Yimou made two movies that year, as he so often does, Roman Polanski, Tim Burton, Steven Soderbergh, Ron Howard, Clint Eastwood, Oliver Stone, Albert Brooks. The list really goes on and on.
Yeah, it's incredible.
Brad Bird makes his debut. Spike Jones, John Sayles, David O. Russell, David Cronenberg, David Fincher, Sidney Pollack, Gary Marshall, Wes Craven, Barry Levinson, Frank Oz, Tim Robbins, Kevin Smith.
Kevin Smith.
Obviously made a movie that year, too. M. Night Shyamalan, Antonio Banderas, Mike Judge, the Wachowskis, Ang Lee, Trey Parker.
Sofia Coppola made her
Sofia Coppola, first absolutely. Film. Yep. Jane Campion. There's a lot I'm leaving off here. But it just, the list itself just shows, I think that people, that directors and filmmakers and artists wanted to make a mark in the year 1999.
Yes.
I think that there was an obvious attempt by directors to do that.
There was a rush to get a film out before the century clicked over, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so because there's such a wide range of films, we were thinking that we would maybe talk about one of the films that we each think is one of the best of 99, and then perhaps one that we think is undervalued, maybe a sleeper hit of 1999. So Heather, maybe let's start with you, because one of your faves, I think, is one of the defining films of that year.
The Matrix.
The Matrix.
Yes. I think it is one of the most popular ones of that year. And I think to a certain degree, we kind of are a little biased. We're so used to it, we take it for granted. So, you know, everyone's seen The Matrix. If you haven't seen The Matrix, it's by the Wachowski sisters, Lily and Lana, and it has stars Keanu Reeves, Lawrence Fishburne, Carrie Ann Moss, dystopian future, which is one of my favorite themes, obviously, if you pay attention.
We've learned.
And so, you know, he learns that Keanu, you know, questions his existence in this regular world that we see. And it's, I was noticing, we're watching it, that there are some good things that they set up. The story of The Matrix is such a original story, and how they present it, showing you that versus you're in The Matrix, this world that we see every day, and then you take it down to the real life, grungy, dirty, rebellious world that the other people who've disconnected have lived in.
So 1999.
Yes.
That's what we were living in, right? 1999.
And thinking what's going to happen next.
Yes.
And so I think it's underappreciated for many reasons because we're so used to it. And if you look at it as a whole, it was so pioneering at the time. I was in film school at the time, so I was all about it, and everyone I knew was about it. They pioneered the bullet time effect with all of the cameras in the arc where you could catch them flying and, like, you know, flying and then avoiding the bullet when he does the lean back. And, you know, that is a cliche now and often made fun of, but it was groundbreaking at the time and amazing. I think all of us were reading up on how they did it. That was the time right before, you know, in terms of school, students were at, like, coming out of film and going into digital. And it was groundbreaking. And I think it's underappreciated. And the story, just, they laid out such a great story. It had such a good premise. And, you know, Keanu, his character Neo, questions what we all question. Where are we living? Is this real world here? Are we dreaming?
Right.
You know, what's real and what's not, and what happens, you know, even when it happens when you die, like, what that kind of thing happens. And it kind of puts a face to it. It says, yes, it gives you an example. Here it is. You're living in the Matrix. Someone is in control of your destiny.
Right. And it tapped into a lot of, we referenced millennial anxiety at that time. I think there was a spate of virtual reality films that came out that year. Existenz, the Cronenberg film, came out around that time, and 13th Floor. So I think we were really questioning, is this the end of something and the beginning of a new something? And what is that going to be? Is it going to be horrible? Is it going to be great? And I think The Matrix sort of indicated it was not going to be great.
Right. Like, we were doomed and we were just going to be used for our energy.
Right.
And
right.
So I think it's a little bit, you know, forgotten, kind of passed along. And maybe the sequels kind of dampened it a little bit because they did not live up to it.
A little bit.
I mean, I remember I remember sitting in the theater after The Matrix ended, and I was such in awe of this story that they presented.
Absolutely.
You know, it was so amazing.
Yeah.
And the you know, the special effects and all of the choreography of the martial arts stuff was also groundbreaking because they hadn't had a movie, at least an American movie, that had been so dedicated and choreographed. I remember it being a big thing that they had all of that going on. And all the actors were involved and they had to learn all of those things. And, you know, the Wachowskis writing this, had all of them read some philosophy books that they wanted to kind of keep them all like-minded in terms of what they were thinking. And, you know, Keanu Reeves, as much as people make fun of him, rightly so sometimes, because there are those moments.
Yeah.
Honestly, I feel like he was born to play Neo. In a way, you know, you know, and he does that switch. You may not, you know, the Neo of The Matrix versus the Neo of the other world. There's a distinction. And I think people just kind of gloss it over because it's Keanu.
And no one could deliver the line. So I told you my favorite line from Matrix is, of course, "Whoa, I know Kung Fu."
Yes.
Nobody could deliver that line like Keanu Reeves.
Yes.
That role was made for him.
Yes. I think it's perfect. And Hugo Weaving as the villain is perfect as well. He's got that voice and that stoic mannerism that's like, I'm calm, but I'm so going to get you. And those shades, the suit, all of that kind of thing goes all together. And I think the reason why the first Matrix did so well was because it was set up. It was setting up how we're getting here. And it had the mystery of who was the, you know, not the mystery didn't last very long, but, you know, who was the infiltrator and who was going to turn against their friends, who Joe Pantoliano like does so well. He's such a jerk, like, so well. And you like all the characters, and it's just so entertaining. And the, and even if you like action flicks, it's not just an action flick. It's got depth and story to it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think the other reason why it worked is Carrie Ann Moss, is she's great in it as well. And her and Neo's, like, burgeoning love is cool, but not the main part of it. And so I think that's kind of what dampened the other sequels, kind of making it more of a love story. But anyways, overall, I think The Matrix is great. I think if you have a chance to watch the non-television version and watch the original, I think people will appreciate it more and not and remember that. It was really, truly groundbreaking at the time.
And cool that it got people talking about philosophy, too, which I remember very distinctly when it came out. People were really into this idea of an alternate reality, and are we dreaming? Are we awake? Are we dreaming? And there's references to the Plato shadows on the cave philosophy. Really smart, but in a blockbuster package. So it's kind of the ultimate conduit for ideas to get into the mainstream audience, you know?
Yeah, it was really great. I just remember sitting in the theater watching it. And when you were saying that it was, you know, it, as far as storytelling goes, it was saying that the future is bleak. But as far as filmmaking goes, when I was watching that, I was excited for the future of filmmaking. I thought for sure this was going to show. I mean, it was groundbreaking to sit there and watch the bullet effect, to watch everything that was happening, to see this action film that was so smart and so clever and that made you think, like, you did kind of sit at the end of it and think about what you had just seen. That doesn't happen with most action flicks.
No.
It was the fifth highest grossing film of the year, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Matrix.
Well, now it's just mostly they focus on effects. How can we make things so great with our CGI stuff? Which The Matrix did, but I think because they were pioneering it, they had to, they knew they had to have a story with it. It's not just I'm going to look at eye candy and, you know, that pulled you along, that made you want to see more. So, yeah, it's interesting. It's an interesting idea. That now we take that for granted, all of the special effects, all of those things.
Well, things have changed. And I think that was indicative of 1999, that there were a lot of great artists making commercial films that today would probably not fly as commercial films.
True.
Action films today are not necessarily based on philosophy. They're based on, action and, you know, CGI. And
there's not much emotion. And now in The Matrix there is... you know, given it's Keanu, but it does it well, and, like, you know,
you don't have to qualify that it's for Keanu because he kills it.
Well, it made, you know, honestly, I spent a long time thinking, would I take the red pill or the blue pill? And I would totally take the blue pill because I don't want to go and live that life in the grungy, dirty, just not my thing.
No,
I get it.
Yeah.
We're all going to live in the Matrix.
Yeah.
It's going to be great.
Yeah. My body's going to be hooked up to something. I'll be supplying power.
It'll be fine.
I'll be a copper
as long as I don't know it.
Yep.
It'll be fine.
We'll
You know, like I pointed out to you guys when we were talking before, I really think that if humanity could make a simulation of the universe, we would do it. We would do it really quickly. And so it's not that far-fetched to question whether we're a simulation, right? Because we would totally do that if we had the capability. We're doing it now. People play the Sims game.
Right.
There are so many different examples of the way we do it already. So it's not that far-fetched to imagine that it could be.
And, you know, the idea of creating our own online personas, which are distinct from our real-life personas, that is a Matrix idea. And we're doing it ourselves willingly.
That's true. I mean, Neo was Neo online. He wasn't Neo in real life.
That's correct, So it was very prophetic in a way.
Yeah,
I think in a lot of ways, actually. And Keanu Reeves is still amazing.
He is.
Like, all these years later.
An underrated masterpiece.
An underrated masterpiece. A topic for another podcast.
Indeed.
Switching gears, obviously, from The Matrix quite dramatically, Rusty, I know one of your faves from that year is Summer of Sam.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I have a ton of films that I love. Like I said, I saw a ton of films at the theater that year. I did not see Summer of Sam at the theater. It wasn't until a couple years later I saw it on DVD. And it really is, it's criminally underseen. It made just under $20 million that year. It ended up losing money. It's a Spike Lee film. Adrian Brody's in it. It's really an amazing cast. It's about the summer in New York City where the son of Sam was going around, the 44 caliber killer was going around and killing young women and young men as well, randomly and indiscriminately. And it had the city on edge. And it also coincided with a huge heat wave in New York City. And in addition to brownouts that were going on. And this, the film also shows the Yankees that year and Reggie Jackson, the amazing display of power that he was putting on for the Yankees. And the movie really is about New York City.
Yes.
New York City is the character that it's kind of about. But in Summer of Sam, I really feel like there's so much that it encapsulates about great filmmaking in 1999. It's got the great filmmaker Spike Lee. He's doing something completely different than he normally does. It's a lot about Italian Americans. And there was some backlash to the fact that he made a film about Italian Americans.
Right.
But he doesn't sugarcoat anything. He really shows you what life was like in 1977 in the 70s. And what it was like in New York. And it really shows so much about what was happening in film of 1999. There's some digital animation that's crudely done. It's not really great.
Oh.
When I watched it again recently, and that there's a scene where the dog talks to Sam, or the son of Sam, who he said that the neighbor's dog told him to go kill people.
Right.
And so Spike Lee shows that in the film and uses computer animation to do it. And it's somewhat crude and it doesn't really work. And it comes off as a little odd in present day. That's the only misstep in the movie, but that was happening in films of 1999. The Phantom Menace came out in 1999 and it was all CGI.
Yes.
And when you look at it now, there are parts of it that are horrendous. There are parts that really work. Well, the pod race scene, I would say.
Just parts, maybe the whole thing. Yeah.
But so that was in Summer of Sam as well. There are comical moments. There's a scene in which, is it Mira Sorvino? She hops out of the car and really rips the rug out from under her husband.
Mm-hmm.
Played by whom, Jeff? Names
John
always
Leguizamo.
Escape me.
John Leguizamo.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. Who's amazing. He's and all great. The performances are so good. But she hops out of the car and she says she's going to go have sex with the next person who comes by. And it really... There's so much about 1999 that I love, but one of the things I loved were there were some amazing female performances. Nicole Kidman in Eyes Wide Shut does the same thing to Tom Cruise. She rips the rug out from him. Oh, you think you're so safe? You think I always want to be with you? How about this? You know, and that's what Mira Sorvino does, too. And so a lot of why I love Summer of Sam, it's an incredible film, and I recommend it highly, highly to anybody. Really thoughtful. You'll need to be in a good space to go watch it. It's kind of profound where it goes a lot of times. Right. There's a lot of scapegoating.
Yeah, but I think it's also important to note, and I remember at the time people were disappointed because it was not a serial killer thriller.
Right.
Even though it's about the son of Sam. But
yeah.
It's not about that. As we talked about, I think that's sort of the MacGuffin, the whole serial killer angle, because it's really about New York and the connections between the people who live there and how the murders affected everyone around in New
York.
Well,
and the fishbowl nature of it all, the claustrophobic. It's got a claustrophobic feel. And just like there's a heat wave, you'll feel maybe hot watching it. Like, I feel that heat wave when I watch that movie. There are some scenes, and the camera work's just amazing in it. It's one of my favorite Spike Lee films. When we did the Spike Lee episode, I almost covered Summer of Sam because I just love it so much. And there's so much, but I feel like it really represents 1999 so well. well. You had these great filmmakers coming out. They were doing new stuff. They were breaking new ground. They were telling nonlinear stories. You get some of that in Summer of Sam as well. And they were breaking of convention. That's certainly the case. You've got you've got Spike Lee doing something that's definitely doesn't feel all the time. The camera work a lot of times feels like a Spike Lee movie, but a lot of the storytelling doesn't. He's got an amazing female character in it. That hasn't been the case up to that point, by and large, for Spike Lee. So he's breaking with his own conventions. He's breaking with film conventions, just like a lot of the great directors of 1999 were. And so I highly recommend Summer of Sam here.
Oh, yeah. It's fantastic. And I think that kind of leads into my pick for my, I think, my favorite movie of the year. One of my favorite movies in general is Magnolia.
Yeah.
Paul Thomas Anderson. So this movie, much like Summer of Sam was sort of an ode to New York, Paul Thomas Anderson has called this his ode to the San Fernando Valley, which feels a little less epic. And he has said that what he was wanting to do was make an epic about something that most people would not think would warrant an epic treatment. So the San Fernando Valley seems to fit, and that's where he grew up. And it's really just this kind of incredible mosaic of people living their lives in California, interconnected stories, giant cast of characters. The film's about chance and coincidence and unexpected connections between people. An amazing cast: Philip Seymour Hoffman, Julianne Moore, Jason Robards. It was his last film.
Tom Cruise.
It's really kind of mind blowing. And this was P.T. Anderson's third film, following Boogie Nights, which is also amazing. Yeah. I think this movie takes a similar structure to Boogie Nights, but really just kind of blows it up. Because one thing that's so great about Magnolia and so risk-taking is that it's taking a lot of chances. And I always like to, I don't know who actually to attribute this quote to, but I think it's been used a lot, that perfection is the enemy of great art. And Magnolia is an amazing film. It's not a perfect film. And I have very distinct fond memories of seeing Magnolia in the theater. I saw it many times in the theater. It's 3 hours. It's an investment. It's a real investment.
It is an investment.
But it's worth every minute that you're watching it. But I distinctly remember the first time I saw the film, about 2 hours in, all of the characters join in a group sing-along. They sing to an Amy Mann song. And I remember a lot of people started getting fidgety, like, this is strange. Now that's becoming this kind of magical realist kind of film.
Like, yeah.
And then, of course, that's not even to talk about the Reign of Frogs that happens later. And that just sent people screaming and running out of the theater, really upset. And I think it's an example of Paul Thomas Anderson saying, I don't care. This is the movie I want to make. I don't care if audiences are going to go with this.
Oh, yeah.
And that's when you get great art, when you stop worrying about what the audience is going to think and you just do it. And to me, Magnolia is the ultimate example of that, because it is kind of messy and it's ragged, but it's brilliant and it's heartrending. And I think the other thing I really love about it is the use of music. And we talked a little bit before we were on air about Amy Mann provides the soundtrack to the film. And P.T. Anderson sort of structured the film around her music and created scenes based on songs that she'd already recorded, had her create new songs for the film. And I think she and her music is a character.
Oh, yeah.
In the film, as much as anyone.
Yeah, if it wasn't there, it wouldn't be the same movie.
No. And I think he harkened back to Cat Stevens doing the soundtrack to Harold and Maude, or Simon and Garfunkel for The Graduate. There's a few examples.
Yeah, there are a few.
Not a lot. And I think P.T. Anderson, I think he's so confident in his filmmaking that he didn't worry about the music overwhelming the film. He integrated it into the film and was very kind of open to that idea that he could collaborate with her and make the film better, which I think it did.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and again, he broke so many conventions with this film. This is something, it was really an artistic statement, and that's what I love about it. I, too, saw it at the theater, not multiple times. I only saw it once, but it felt profound. When I walked out of there, I knew I had seen great art. Mm-hmm. And it, too, it is right in the same spot as Summer of Sam in that it made about $20 million. It lost money.
Yes.
That year, unfortunately, I'm glad that Paul Thomas Anderson was able to still raise money for later films afterwards, but it lost money. But it to me is one of the best films from 1999.
Yeah, and I think he was given total artistic control because Boogie Nights was a hit, and I really think because Tom Cruise was in it, I think the studio was much more willing.
I remember they marketed it like
as a Tom Cruise film.
Tom Cruise, like you've never seen him before, because he's the guy that plays the self-help, egotistical
Frank T.J. Mackey.
Arrogant.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
Yeah. So kind of if you haven't seen the film, Tom Cruise kind of plays a motivational speaker, televangelist, creep,
who's telling men to empower themselves.
Yes, by dating or not dating, having sex with as many women as possible.
Yeah.
Promoting penis power is kind of his thing.
Oh, I forgot about that part.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's kind of a horrible role. And, you know, no disparaging remarks about Tom Cruise here, but I think he's perfect for this role.
You saw him like you never saw him before.
Right. And I think that's why he's so
good. As an asshole.
Yeah.
Yeah, as a complete jerk. And I think Tom Cruise is such a tightly controlled actor. I think before this, he was always very careful about his image and not to project an unlikable image.
True.
And so I think he just like ripped loose in this.
Yeah.
And I've read interviews with Tom Cruise where he did this film right after Eyes Wide Shut, the Kubrick film, which he worked on for several years and was playing this very repressed, uptight character. And he said that the chance to play this character in Magnolia was great because it allowed him to sort of just unleash his id in the film. And you can see it. Like, he's really just, like, attacking this role.
Yeah, that's true. And he got so much press. I mean,
he did.
In a way, it kind of... not quite, but they wanted to make it a Tom Cruise vehicle, and it wasn't, so...
Yeah.
But
I think it helped kind of legitimize him as a serious actor in a lot of ways.
Eyes Wide Shut, and then...
At that point, you're working with Stanley Kubrick and Paul Thomas Anderson. I mean, those are two of the biggest artists going.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and strangely, he got the only acting Oscar nomination out of the film because there's a lot of amazing actors in it.
But, if you think about it. But anyway.
But I mean, he was great, but.
Julianne Moore alone deserved an Oscar for that. Her performance is amazing. We talked about it a little, but in the pharmacy where she breaks down.
The freakout scene.
Oh, my gosh. It breaks your heart, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It really breaks my heart to see it.
Yeah. And I think I should give a special shout out to Philip Seymour Hoffman, who, you know, was one of my favorite actors. I think a lot of people feel that way. He plays Jason Robards' caregiver in the film, and he's so compassionate. Even thinking about him kind of makes me well up.
Yeah.
Because that's such a great... I think only Philip Seymour Hoffman could play such an emotionally naked character as he does in this film. And it's just incredible. Great.
And William H. Macy, too, right?
Yes.
He's singing that song in the car. Every time I picture that...
He too is. Yeah. He breaks your heart.
Oh yeah,
with his performance, he's a child star, grown up, and now just looking for some amount of respect. Can't find it from his job. Can't find it where he hangs out. Doesn't even seem to have friends. It's a really, really great performance from him.
Yeah, and everyone in the movie is broken, which I love. Yes. But the movie itself is so exhilarating because the filmmaking is so crazy, great, and propulsive and kinetic. So it's not really depressing, and you think it would be depressing, but it's very much not. And it's hopeful at the end. I love the fact that the film ends on a smile. It's the most broken character turns to the camera and just smiles, and it's great. Like, that's the brilliant ending that this movie needed. And
who plays the police officer?
John C. Reilly.
John C. Reilly, yeah. Oh, yeah.
He's so good as that role.
Yeah.
It's amazing stuff.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, see Magnolia when you got 3 hours to kill, and you will love it.
It'll be worth it.
So Magnolia was not a huge hit, but there were a number of films that were maybe undervalued from 1999. So we all have also a favorite. We're calling it a sleeper pick, something that maybe deserves to be rediscovered. So Heather, what is your rediscovery from 1999?
My rediscovery is Jim Jarmusch's Ghost Dog, Way of the Samurai.
Yes.
Woo-hoo.
Yes.
Which I had only seen it once, but it had left such a impression on me that I, you know, it was one of my favorite sleepers. It made very little money. I think if I recall looking, it made like $4 million or $5 million, something like that. And typical Jarmusch, like low-key. It's a quiet movie. In his way. It stars Forrest Whitaker, and it has so Forrest Whitaker is the most named, you know, recognized name in that movie.
Right.
The other actors are either been in his previous movies or are just like character actors. So Forrest Whitaker plays a hitman, and the way he goes about being a hitman is the Way of the Samurai. And it's sort of mixed. I was reading reviews, and it's true. He mixes genres. He's mixing mafia genre because he's a hitman for the mafia mob. And then they're mixing samurai genre because throughout the movie, they have passages from a book on the Way of the Samurai. And he tells you how you should be living your life as a samurai. And all of those passages match up to what happens in the story. It's brilliant the way he matches it up. But so here's Forrest Whitaker living a very solitary life, a Way of the Samurai. And, you know, he has pigeons. He lives on the roof of a building. He has messenger pigeons. And he communicates with people who want to hire him to be a hitman by these messenger pigeons, which is amusing to a certain degree. Because you're like, what? And so he has this old world sensibility because of the samurai. And it mixed in this 1990s world. And so what happens is earlier in his life, John Torme's character, who's one of the mafia guys, saves him from getting beaten up and potentially getting killed in the neighborhood. And so Forrest Whitaker feels like he owes him. And you know, Forrest Whitaker goes by the name Ghost Dog. So Ghost Dog now owes him his life. He calls him, "I'm your retainer." And so he goes about, he waits, he communicates with John Torme's character through the messenger pigeons, and he gets instructions to kill some guy named Handsome Frank.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
And which is hilarious because it's filling in that stereotypical mob lifestyle of those names and, right. You know. So he goes and kills Handsome Frank, but unfortunately there's a woman there and she wasn't supposed to be there. And she's the daughter of one of the lead mobsters. And he doesn't kill her because he wasn't instructed to kill her. And she's reading the book Rashomon. So he takes the book with him when he leaves, and he leaves her alive. And that becomes the problem. So she's seen him. He's seen her. And he's going about his business. You know, he lives alone. In his life, he has one friend, and it's the ice cream guy. And the ice cream guy speaks only French. And he calls him his best friend, yet they don't understand each other. The language of each other.
Yeah.
And so it's funny because it just proves that, you know, even though language is super important, when you're in a relationship with someone, friendship, romantic, whatever, you can communicate without even knowing it because all of their dialogue is the same. So he'll say, "He's my best friend." And then the French guy talks and he's like, "He's my best friend, mon ami," you know? And so it's very interesting relationship.
And that's a common Jarmusch theme.
Yes.
Characters who don't understand the language, but they still connect.
Yeah. And they have that. They're both, you know, the French guy doesn't talk about his family. So he implies that he's an immigrant. And so I feel like they're kind of on that same wavelength. They don't have family here. And so that's how they connect. And so it goes about the mob. People realize, oh, we must kill him, must kill Ghost Dog because he saw the woman and which doesn't make sense. I mean, that part's a little foggy because they wanted Handsome Frank dead. So they got him dead, but because the woman was there, it messes up everything. And so, and you know, the scenes with the mobsters are very stereotypical dialogue, but they're old and they're overweight. So that is hilarious because when they go searching for Ghost Dog to kill him, there's these chubby old guys like up the stairs, like breathing heavy with their guns. Like, it's very hilarious. So it's a weird juxtaposition between the two of like, here's you flash to Ghost Dog praying and doing his samurai ways. And then you have this mobster.
Yeah.
You know, it's an interesting, anyway, it's an interesting like two sides of the world.
It's sort of a philosophical genre movie because it is, I mean, it is a gangster mob movie, but it's really kind of quiet and contemplative. Yes. And Forrest Whitaker is just so solid and assured and quiet.
Yeah, it's, there's no moment of him breaking character ever.
No,
and he is the best part of this film, and I'm curious to know how he cast him, but I didn't read up on that part. But the other part of this movie that should be noted is the soundtrack is done by RZA, and he's from Wu-Tang Clan, and there's Wu-Tang music. And,
oh, that's right.
And honestly, I mean, that I listened to that at that time anyway, so I loved that. I still love the soundtrack. It's amazing. And it goes along with, if you know any of the Wu-Tang stories and on how they have that samurai story along with them as well,
right,
in their music. So it's interesting. That's an interesting side note for people who like music. But anyway, so it goes along and they're trying to find this guy who lives on the only know his name is Ghost Dog and that he lives on the roof with pigeons, and they end up finding him after a few things and they end up killing all of his pigeons. And the scene where you see him and he's confronting all of his dead pigeons is like, he doesn't say a word, but you see that in his eyes that he's so heartbroken because this was his only thing. And you want him to get revenge because they've just destroyed one of the few things that he has. So anyways, it's such a quiet film. There's not a huge amount of dialogue, especially in the beginning.
Right.
And there's a lot of Forrest Whitaker driving around listening to music, which is important because it gives you the idea of how lonely he is. And that was the other thing that I noticed, is it made me feel uncomfortable a little bit, and it didn't dawn on me till later that it's because you feel lonely watching this movie. And it's not necessarily a good feeling, but Jarmusch does so well representing what loneliness is, to live by yourself, to be, you know, and to have this lone job as a hitman. You know, the idea that we have as what a hitman's life is, that's kind of what you think it is in my book, instead of the one that Hollywood wants you to project. So I won't go through the whole story. I'll leave it some to your a mystery. Yes. But it's such a great story. It's a quiet movie, and if you really want to get into characters and this and the samurai stuff, I definitely recommend Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai.
Oh, that's great. And I always have thought that he would actually be a good character in Magnolia.
Yeah.
The Forrest Whitaker character, because he's this kind of lonely,
probably broken.
Maybe looking for connection, but not really knowing how to do it.
That's so true.
Yeah.
It's very Jarmusch and P.T. Anderson in that way. it's a good movie. I don't think you would regret watching it.
No.
Jarmusch is somebody who really knows how to have a film that captures feeling, that is about a feeling. Broken Flowers, you know, is about that sense that life has something else out there for you that you've somehow missed, you know, and the sense of loneliness. Mm-hmm. That's what Jarmusch does just so freaking well. And I love Ghost Dog. I loved it when I saw it. I can't wait to see it again.
But also, he's great with bone dry humor. I mean, this movie's very funny.
Yes, there are funny moments.
But I don't think you would call it a comedy necessarily. And I think people would watch it and not laugh, like certain people, if you're not clued into what his wavelength is in terms of comedy, which is kind of the case with a lot of Jarmusch films.
That's true.
I find them hilarious, but I've known people who just sit there stony face. They're not like, why aren't you laughing? This is hilarious.
Yeah.
Because it's so dry.
Oh, the scenes with the ice cream truck, the Haitian ice cream truck guy are hilarious. They are very funny and super sweet, too.
Oh, yeah.
Because those are his moments where he's not lonely. Right. That's his friend.
When he already knows, like, I'm going to get you a chocolate ice cream cone. That's his thing. And it's like, that's his sense of familiarity in his life.
And Jarmusch is, as I mentioned before, I think he's such a great humanist director because he really believes in people connecting and that it's possible from people from different cultures to find common ground, even if they don't speak the same language.
Yeah.
I think he's such a great, great filmmaker. And really deep and thoughtful and funny.
Yeah. So check out Ghost Dog and any other Jarmusch movie I would recommend too.
And speaking of the humor angle of Jarmusch, so Rusty, one of your sleeper picks is a flat out comedy.
Yeah. Bowfinger. It's so another one that's just criminally underseen, I feel like. I don't know how much money it made, but it wasn't a lot. I think it did make more than Magnolia and Iron Giant. So.
Probably. Yeah.
But it's a Frank Oz movie. He directed it, which is interesting in and of itself. He directed quite a few really good little movies. Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, In and Out.
Little Shop of Horrors.
Little Shop of Horrors. And it was written by stars Steve Martin and Eddie Murphy. And Steve Martin is a man who makes movies. He lives in Hollywood, but he is not a big time filmmaker at all. But he is certain that he's an artist and that he's a filmmaker, and he's got people around him who believe in him and he's got his production company of sorts. And so he's going to make a movie, and this time it's going to be his magnum opus. It's going to be, he's got this great script that his accountant wrote, and he's going to make the film Chubby Rain, which is a film about aliens.
It's
all hilarious. But he's going to make it. And the thing about the Steve Martin character, Bowfinger is his name, he's part Ed Wood, but he's not as sweet and innocent as Ed Wood. He's got a con man element about him.
Right.
So he's kind of smarmy, and he convinces his friends, well, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to hire the big time superstar Kit Ramsey, who's played by Eddie Murphy. I'm going to have him in our movie. And he convinces his friends that they're going to be in the movie and the other actors. He has not hired Kit Ramsey. He can't do that with his $2,200 or whatever it is he has to make this movie. And so what he does is he is going to make the movie without Kit Ramsey's knowing that he's in it. And he tells the people, oh, he knows he's in it, but he, just like in the Hollywood tradition, he can't talk to the other actors.
Right.
And so they start following him and tracking his movements. Kit Ramsey, who's played by Eddie Murphy, and they scare the bejesus out of him. He's crazy anyway. He's a big time action star. He's kind of playing himself, Eddie Murphy.
Exactly.
And he's in Scientology, and he's surrounded by sycophants, and he's certain of all sorts of crazy things. He's absolutely bonkers, but he's so insulated and makes so much money that it's accepted that he is. But because these actors of Bowfingers are coming up to him and talking to him about aliens and everything else, he starts really thinking that something's happening.
He's very paranoid. And yeah,
it makes him even more paranoid. And he's hilarious. Eddie Murphy in this movie, his facial expressions alone sell the movie for me. I mean, I love it. I love Eddie Murphy's facial expressions as Kit Ramsey. But he also plays a second character in the movie. He plays a Kit Ramsey lookalike who cannot act at all, but Bowfinger finds him and is going to use him as a butt stunt double,
right?
For his butt, because he's got such a great ass.
A butt double, yes. They think
like
in Hollywood.
You really have a great ass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so they use him, and then because he looks so much like Kit Ramsey, they use him for other things, and they have him run across the freeway in broad daylight in L.A.
Right.
And they're like, oh, no, this is how all the big time movies do it.
Yeah.
Use that fear.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you've been in L.A. and on the freeway, is the notion of
surviving out there on foot. No way.
But it's hilarious. And Eddie Murphy in both the roles is absolutely incredible. Heather Graham is in it as well.
Yep. She's funny. Yeah,
she's very funny, and she's going to get her way to the top. I guess kind of the old fashioned way. She's just going to sleep her way to the top.
Oh, yes.
Doesn't matter who. First, she is ready to sleep with the accountant because he wrote the script and can now write her into more parts. And then he just keeps going. She keeps going from there, works her way up. And then in the end, she's with Kit Ramsey very briefly before ending up with the most powerful lesbian in Hollywood. And it's a thinly veiled shot at Anne Heche, who Steve Martin dated for a while.
Right.
And her relationship with Ellen DeGeneres. And so as it's a movie within a movie, there's a lot of interesting commentary on Hollywood, and it's really great commentary. It's really great comedy and so underseen. And I'll tell you what, too, is as we had talked a little bit The 1990s were not good to Steve Martin.
No, it was a bad decade for him.
He made a bunch of bad stuff in the 1990s.
Mixed Nuts and Sergeant Bilko. That's all I have to say.
Yeah.
Bad.
Yeah.
House sitter.
Yeah.
But the 80s, he was on fire, of course. And then 90s, not so much.
Eddie Murphy kind of was in the same boat.
Yes.
In 1999, I didn't see Bowfinger at the theaters, but in 1999, if you had asked me, I would have told you that Eddie Murphy's comedy career was pretty done, that he didn't have a whole lot left in the tank for comedy.
Right.
Bowfinger shows you that's not the case. Not only is he funny as can be in it, he also, as the butt stunt double, Who's the character name I forget right now, but it's really touching. He's a really good actor in it, too.
He can act when, like Tom Cruise. When necessary, they can really act. But they're not often given the opportunity because they have such big star personas.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, you get to see that, too, in Eddie Murphy as Kit Ramsey and his whole thing. I've used this forever since then, is what his therapist talks to him about is like, okay, what are you going to do? I'm going to... Kit. I'm going to keep it together. I got to keep it together. And it's so funny. And it's, I just can't recommend Bowfinger enough. I watched it again just in the last week. It holds up incredibly well, better than most of the comedies. I've watched other comedies. I watched Superstar to prepare for this. Mm. Doesn't hold up as well. Bowfinger holds up very well. It's a very funny movie. Yeah.
And an interesting companion, because Steve Martin started the 90s with L.A. Story, which he wrote, and then ended the decade with Bowfinger, which is also sort of an ode to L.A.,
That's
the filmmaking side of it. So that's kind of a good double feature if you've got several hours to kill.
Mm. I enjoyed L.A. Story.
Yeah, that's a good double feature. Like you say, I would totally do that sometime.
Yeah. So my sleeper pick is one that I still, to this day, I've seen it many times. I still don't know exactly how to classify it. But I would call it, if I had to, a black comedy, horror, western, thriller, cannibal drama.
Period piece,
yeah.
Not a musical, although there's a lot of music in it, but it's not a musical. Ravenous, starring Guy Pearce, Robert Carlyle from Trainspotting, David Arquette pops up in it, Jeremy Davies is in it.
Oh, yeah.
So this is the kind of movie that I love. And this movie was a huge flop. Huge flop. Infamous flop. Troubled production history. It had three different directors. One was fired after about a month. The other one, another director was brought on board. The cast hated him. He was fired. Antonia Bird, who is a great British filmmaker, was brought on board. She finished the film. She then later denounced it, saying that 20th Century Fox added footage that she didn't have any control over. She didn't like the final product. But I think, and it had like constant rewrites while they were making it. And I think it's because they didn't know what kind of movie it was.
Yeah.
And you can tell. But I think,
sounds about right.
Yeah. But I think all of the angst that went into making the film made it the interesting film that it is. So what it is... is a story set in 1847. Guy Pearce, this is right after the Mexican-American War. Guy Pearce is an army captain. After the war, he's had some traumatic incident. We get glimpses of what it was. It was something kind of horrifying. So he's basically sent to this remote outpost in the Sierra Nevadas in the dead of winter. They think we're just going to get rid of him because he's a loose cannon, because he's had this traumatic incident. And he starts believing that cannibals have infiltrated this army outpost. And then it turns out that maybe he's not actually paranoid, and there may actually be cannibals afoot in this army outpost. And then, you know, like crazy hijinks ensue. Like cannibals do end up coming into the outpost. People are eaten. Stories are shared. Songs are sung.
It's a good description.
Yeah. And it's based on loosely on the story of Alfred Packer, the real life cannibal in the 1800s who ate. He was a prospector in Colorado, ate five other men while they were crossing the Rockies in the dead of winter. They got trapped. They made Trey Parker and Matt Stone made Cannibal the Musical based on the story. So this is loosely based on that. And it's really... This is so when we were talking about Magnolia, I was referring to how perfection is the enemy of art. There's also another cliche and I don't know who said this, but you can't make an omelet without cracking a few eggs. Ravenous is all cracked eggs.
Yeah.
But it's delicious. It's delicious. If you can say that about a cannibal movie, I would say it's delicious. And it's really, it's funny. It's a good litmus test because it's very funny, but you can see it with people who don't think it's funny. They think it's horrifying.
Well, it's scary.
And it's scary and it's gory.
And it's gory, yeah.
Yeah. But very funny. There's an amazing sequence where the men are sleeping out in the middle of nowhere in the snow in a tent. And one of them may be a cannibal. They don't know which one it is. And one of them wakes up in the middle of the night, turns on his flashlight, not his flashlight, his torch, and screams, "He licked me." So someone was testing him out to see if they could eat him.
He was tasty.
Yeah. And there's also a lot of interesting kind of homoerotic overtones. The climax involves Guy Pearce and Robert Carlyle falling on top of each other, being snapped in a giant bear trap where they're both probably going to die. And Robert Carlyle very, I think, intimately asks Guy Pearce, "If I die first, will you eat me? Because if you die first, I'm definitely going to eat you."
Which is awesome.
Which is beautiful.
With a real sweet look in his eye, too.
It's a real sweet look. It's beautiful. Yeah. So this is the kind of movie I love, that you just don't know how you're supposed to be reacting to it.
Yeah.
I think so many movies are pre-programmed in a way, like, you know, going in how you're going to react. I'm going to think this is funny. I'm going to think this is scary. I'm going to be moved or whatever it is. Ravenous, you have no idea from moment to moment what's going on.
No, it's true.
Which is kind of thrilling in a way.
Yeah. And it just keeps you guessing the whole time, too. I mean, the set and costume design are so nice in it. Mm-hmm. Like, it's way better than you would expect a period horror movie to be.
It was a big budget studio film. They lavished a lot of money on it. And I'm not sure why, because the concept was so wacky and crazy. I'm not sure what they were thinking they were going to get out of this film beyond a cult film, which it is.
Yeah. That's what it feels like. It feels like a cult film that would have a cult following that not everybody will appreciate for sure.
No, and I would...
So again, it's hard to understand.
Since we're talking about music, it's got great jaunty bluegrass music with very strange synthesizer and Gregorian chanting music. It's the definition of eccentric. This movie is eccentric.
Yeah.
It's in the dictionary under eccentric. There's a picture of Ravenous.
Well, there's the scene when the two guys go into the cave to see if anybody's still in there, to see if the cannibals are in the cave. And the guy who's left out, who's the cannibal, he starts doing weird stuff with his hands. And then he starts digging real fast in the dirt. Like, it's bizarro.
Right.
It's bizarro. Yeah.
It's really hard to understand, but it's so interesting to look at. Like, I just couldn't take my eyes off of it. I kept watching it. Because it is so different.
Yeah, and I think that was a good example of a 1999 film. A major studio thought, this is going to be a great mainstream idea. People are really going to go for it because people were trying, like, studios were trying things then.
Yeah, that's true. They were willing to risk.
Right.
That's not what's happening. No.
No. It's a far cry.
So check out Ravenous. It's a good Thanksgiving movie, obviously. So
watch it before you eat, maybe?
Watch it before, after, or during you eat.
Yes. I ate it during my lunch, and I really did. Well, don't laugh too much, Heather. You used it as a date movie.
Yeah, but I didn't know at the time what I was getting into. I watched the trailer, and I thought, this looks really cool. And I asked this person who I went on to date for a while, and I didn't think about it, but in hindsight, I thought, what were you thinking? You invited someone on your second or third date to a cannibal movie? What was
that? See, even I didn't do that.
No.
Yeah.
Even I wouldn't take a date to see that movie.
So I ate it during my lunch, but I didn't I didn't take my new girlfriend to go see it and have them learn about me that way.
And yet I did. And yet I did glean a great relationship line from it. If I die first, will you eat me? Because I'm going to eat you if you die first. Because I think that's very romantic.
It is.
Very sweet.
And that's how you can tell if someone's in it for the long haul with you.
I should have asked him that. We did go on to date for about a year. So
Okay, well.
It didn't ruin everything.
Successful. Yeah. You know, we should just talk about some of the other films from 1999.
Yes.
This isn't going to be something we bring back up necessarily, but it was such a groundbreaking year. And I think one example of how groundbreaking it was is that David Lynch made a G-rated movie.
Yes.
For Disney?
For Disney, the straight story for Disney Studios.
Yeah. So
it's great.
David Lynch doing Disney movies, and it is amazing. It's about a man who's estranged from his brother, and his brother's had a stroke, and he needs to go see his brother, who lives quite a ways away. He doesn't have any money, so he decides to ride his lawnmower, and it's based on a true story.
It actually happened, yeah.
Yeah, and it's Richard Farnsworth is the star. He was nominated for an Academy Award, wasn't he, or did he win?
He was,
yeah.
And then he died soon after.
Yeah, he had bone cancer when he was making it, and he mostly kept that to himself. He was in pain the whole time he was on the lawnmower. Like, it was very painful for him to make the movie, but I read that it was rather cathartic for him, too. But The Straight Story is one of David Lynch's films that nobody really talks about as a David Lynch film. It's incredible.
Yeah, he was taking a real chance, and that was 1999, I think, in a nutshell. You're taking chances.
Yeah.
And he did.
Yeah.
He did. Fight Club, of course, is probably one of the biggest cult films today that came out of 1999.
Sure. Well, and I would say it's one of the top 10 films of that year, Fight Club. It also lost money.
It was a money loser, yes.
Yeah, it was a flop. We've talked about that before.
That's
that
so
it was
crazy.
A flop.
Yeah.
I mean, it probably gained money in distribution, but like in DVD and
exactly.
whatever
yeah.
sells.
Yeah. And Blair Witch Project came out in 99, which changed the face of horror films and the use of technology and the genre with the found footage concept, which we're still dealing with today.
Yeah.
Well, and it was so different that people were throwing up because of they would get motion sickness watching the movie. They weren't used to seeing it. We see it everywhere now.
Yeah.
That kind of footage is everywhere on YouTube. It's in movies all over the place. Mm-hmm. It's something we actually take for granted.
Yeah, for sure.
But at the time, it was so different that people were going to the theater and getting sick because of the camera work.
And also one of the first films to really effectively use internet promotion. There were the fake websites, which convinced some of us.
Me.
Kind of me for a while. That it was a real story, that it was an actual documentary. It was based on real incident that had happened, which was totally bogus, but the website was brilliant.
Yeah, it got me to the theater. I probably wouldn't have watched it had I not had that internet experience.
We were so much more innocent then.
Yeah, well, it was
kind of amazing.
We're not used to it.
Yeah.
We didn't have many computers in our pockets.
Right.
You know, it's noted, Blair Witch Project made it okay for filmmakers to use more digital content. than before. That was also something important that was new.
That's a really good point.
Yeah.
I love Sweet and Low Down, Woody Allen's film from 1999. Mm-hmm. Stars Sean Penn. I like Sean Penn pretty much anytime he's in anything.
Yeah.
It's really sweet. It's really lovely little film. He's a guitarist in the vein of Django Reinhardt. He says he's probably the second best guitarist in the world. It's really mm-hmm. sweet. Kind of a mockumentary. Or at least fake documentary feel about it. People are talking about him. They talk, the character from Sweet and Low Down. I forget his name right offhand, but I love that movie. Is there anything else you guys really... Being John Malkovich, we haven't talked about.
Being John Malkovich is one of my favorites. Great Charlie Kaufman, Spike Jonze.
Amazing pairing.
Amazing pairing, yeah. And probably one of the funniest movies about fame... And
true.
The most interesting movies that I've ever seen.
That was something that was never done before.
No. And the first film to try to make Cameron Diaz look unattractive, which was interesting.
Yeah.
With
they
the frizzy.
They
made a big deal about that at the time, I remember. But brilliant, talented Mr. Ripley came out that year, which I think is great.
Yeah, I almost did that one for this podcast.
Yeah, it's
I still
so
haven't
good.
Seen it.
It's so good. And I didn't know that there was a series of books, so I'm planning on reading
those. Patricia Highsmith, yes. Yeah.
And the Limey Soderbergh was that year.
Yeah.
That was great.
We've talked about The Iron Giant and how incredible that is. Animation changed in 1999. You had this amazing film, one of the best animated features ever, The Iron Giant, with some the directorial debut of Brad Bird and some amazing writing on his part. You also had South Park, bigger, longer, uncut.
Uncut.
Which brought us great songs like Fuck Fuck your fucking face, Uncle Fucker. Mm-hmm. Blame Canada.
Kyle's mom is a big fat bitch. All the classics are in that film.
Well, and didn't that provide us one of the best Robin Williams moments ever when he sings Blame Canada at the Academy Awards?
Yes.
That was one of the best musical numbers ever.
Uncle Fucker deserved a nomination as well, I would say, but for obvious reasons,
I believe Blame Canada was the first Oscar-nominated song with profanity in it. So it was really great to see how the Academy had to grapple with that. And they did.
Mm-hmm. They did. No, really. And it holds up. It's a very good film. Toy Story 2 also came out in 1999. John Lasseter directed Toy Story 2. At this point now, Toy Story was the first completely computer-generated animated film. This is a sequel, obviously. It's as good as the original. It's a really great story, but now we're seeing that this is the future of animation.
Right.
Is Toy Story 2. It really takes us in and ushers in the great wave of animation we would see afterwards.
Yeah, and there weren't a lot of theatrically released sequels to animated films at that point.
No.
Yeah.
They were like direct-to-DVD sequels, but this was a legitimate big film. And now, of course, Pixar sequelizes most everything.
For better or worse.
Yeah, exactly. And I just wanted to give a shout-out to 1999 comedy. So, you know, we talked about Bowfinger, but it was also the year of Office Space.
Oh, that's right.
Mike Judge, which I think is also fairly prophetic, and I think did not do well on its initial release, but I think people found it because people realized, oh, yes, I have a horrible office job. I relate to this. And then, of course, we had The American Office, and this year American Pie came out, sort of brought back the raunchy teen sex comedy. So 99 had a lot of kind of... influential moments happening in different genres.
Yeah, all the way across the board. Horror, sci-fi, animation.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what we didn't mention at all? Did we? I don't think we mentioned the fact that M. Night Shyamalan made The Sixth Sense, which also changed film.
Yes, changed film storytelling. For sure.
Everything now, I mean, the twist ending is... It existed before. It's not that it didn't exist, but he made it such a huge and important part of the film.
Right. And I think that's the film that made a twist ending become part of the marketing of a film also.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe The Crying Game started it a little bit.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
But I think Sixth Sense really broke it to the mass audience. And people loved it. And then I think he has spent a lot of his career trying to live up to that.
Trying to do another Sixth Sense.
Yeah,
because like, let it go. You're not going to do it. It's not happening.
You can't top that twist ending. But that was certainly another groundbreaker.
Yeah, sure. And it's influenced film.
Yep.
Here we are 17 years later, and it's still important.
Yep. So I think we're kind of winding down here. So, check out some films from 1999. Pretty much anything you watch is probably going to be interesting. Even if you don't love it, it'll at least be interesting. I wanted to thank Heather and Rusty for sharing all this great info. And I want you to please consider checking us out on the MinirulesOfFilmClub.com. Check us out on iTunes. Get in touch with us. Let us know topics you're interested in. This is going to lead me to rule number 910 of the Many Rules of Film Club, which is you can pick your friends, you can't pick your family, and the holidays are coming up, so get ready. So we're going to look at dysfunctional family classics on the Many Rules of Film Club. All right. See you next time.